Leadership is inviting, encouraging, and nudging and pushing us to come to terms with the racism that has existed within our own institution.
This is Wine, Women, and Revolution with your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. And welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. You can find us online at www.njrevolutionradio.com. Follow us on all the social medias and get us wherever you get your podcasts from. Today, I have someone rejoining me back for an interview today. I spoke to Pastor Blake Spencer. Oh, it's probably been almost a year now since last I talked to you. And we spoke a little bit about transgender rights. And the evolution of the church as far as people, transgender, LGBT people. So I want to welcome you back to the show.
Thank you.
It's good to have you back here.
And I just want to make a point that your show is wine. Where is the wine? You didn't bring the wine. Is it too early for wine, I guess?
It might be.
Okay, let's go for it.
If you come to my studio, you get wine. You
know?
I'm actually sitting in his office in the church, and I haven't burst into flames yet, so I don't know what's going on here. But what we're talking about today was you posted on your Facebook page a few weeks ago. I wanted to read your exact post because it started this whole thought process. The church can no longer ignore racism, the Black Lives Matter kind. Purple church is an excuse that allows racism.
I did write that, didn't I?
Yes, you did. And so obviously not being a religious person, my first question is, what is a purple church?
Purple church. Well, predominantly white. Of course, all of this is from my perspective, my experience, my opinion. And I've been doing it for 31 years. So I have a pretty good perspective. Purple church is, I think, a phenomenon in predominantly white congregations. And we'll say, oh, we're a diverse church. And the way we describe our diversity is through our political convictions, which are mainly Republican and Democrat, which in our country we've attached colors to our politics. We don't have many green. I guess we do have some green, but we've not factored that in. So okay. I don't know what that would make us.
But mainly, it's purple with a greenish
mainly
tint.
Purple and red and blue. And so Democrats and Republicans. And so those two colors make purple. And that's just this become kind of this catchphrase.
It's a goal to try to be apolitical, I guess. That's the stated purpose, at least.
For a lot of reasons, yeah. I mean, that's basically to basically say, be quiet.
Okay.
Be very quiet about your political convictions within the church. So it immediately gets attached to the idea of separation of church and state.
Right.
But it's not reality to say that the church and people in church can be completely disengaged with politics. That's just not reality. Nor does it have to do with this person called Jesus that we apparently follow. He was not apolitical.
Right.
And he was, he responded and commented and acted in many ways in response to the political situation within religious communities and within the villages and the communities that he worked in. So the church has always had space to offer commentary, to work against particular topics that we define as unjust. And so that it's not fair to say that you can't say anything political.
And I think especially when we're talking about racism, we're talking about people's acknowledging people's humanity and right to exist unmolested by a system. I mean, that's where racism is now. People's very existence is being called into question and their rights to not be murdered by people. So there's some morality discussion there to be had. That shouldn't necessarily even be a political discussion. That's a morality discussion.
Exactly. So a lot of the social topics that have politics connected to them also have moral, ethical issues, which the church has a lot of room, and people of faith have a calling to care about and to speak about. So I wrote about racism. I was at a national gathering of our denomination, and that was the topic of the day. The Presbyterian Church USA, the leadership and the movement is pretty much inviting, encouraging, and nudging and pushing us to come to terms with the racism that has existed within our own institution and is the reason why we've been a predominantly white denomination for 300 years, you know, and coming to terms with the racism. But it's not the only topic. So any of the social topics fit in this category. The racism, sexism, and homophobia. And those are the three that have just rocked rocked the church to its foundation. We've fought each other. We've split apart from each other. It's fed into that purple church phenomenon of just, you need to be quiet. So purple church would be a gathering of people. We're never half and half. You know? Right. There are some churches that are fortunate to be one color, you know, I would say fortunate. And I'll explain that later. I've served a lot of churches that were purple. And the main message to me as a leader is be quiet. Do not make us uncomfortable. Do not speak that from the pulpit or in the halls of this church. Or, and what we always say is, we will be fired. So purple church has created this kind of intimidating environment that has just virtually made us silent. Pastors are afraid to speak to lose their jobs, and congregants are afraid to speak just to lose their place in church or their comfort in church. So it's all been about comfort and be quiet. So for how many years have we gone through this, through all these years, and been fairly silent? We have been abundantly silent on racism.
Yeah, there's been a deafening silence about addressing racism.
Yes.
In predominantly white churches.
Yes.
You know, black churches deal with subjects of racism because they have to. Yeah. There's no one's comfortable there, you know, like the realities of it are hitting them every day. And it's sort of a intentional blind eye. It felt like it has been. So now you're saying there's a little bit of a opening there.
Well, there's an opening.
A small
opening. Here and there. Our denomination has elected, so we don't have a pope and we don't have bishops, but we do have people that serve at the higher levels of our denomination. And we have, in the last 5 or so years, elected African-American leaders in our congregation. Our clerk of our denomination, he's the one that speaks officially. He's the one that will send letters to the president or whoever else saying that we are against those camps down on the southern border. We are against, you know, and he writes that. So it's become a topic that we are talking about. And then in pockets of church, it's still, Purple Church will still kill that conversation pretty quick.
Now, I recall, I don't remember the exact term, but I think before when I was interviewing you, you said that there is a group that was designed to sort of push the conversation about LGBTQ issues mm-hmm. within the church.
Right.
Do they also, is that group also tasked with pushing the conversation about racial issues or?
Yeah, racial issues. That's more like Presbyterians. And we also have another group that's Covenant Network of Presbyterians. But more like Presbyterians is the one that is an LGBTQIA organization serving LGBTQIA folks in the church. And they have been very, very articulate about that racism's part of the LGBTQIA mm-hmm. community as well.
Right. There and are people so of color are, who are LGBTQ. You absolutely. Can't split your identity and so, only discuss.
So in that aspect, I just recently went to a national gathering in Baltimore. And so the hot topic or the big topic of the moment was racism. And so we're sitting in an assembly hall, a smaller group than has been in the past, but pretty much those of us who have gone are kind of, they're preaching to the choir, you know what I mean? We have gone, yeah, we're going to embrace this topic of racism. We understand, as white people, the white people that are there, we understand that that has been an issue in the church, and we're willing and ready to begin doing what we need to do. And but also in that grouping are Korean Presbyterians, Latino Presbyterians, Black Presbyterians, and our preachers and speakers of that event were Latino and Black. And so I was sitting there going, yeah, I'm telling my children, I have a Black son with children, and so I'm a biracial family, and but I'm always still a white man, you know. I never get out of that reality. But I was sitting in the conference and going, okay, we are hitting heavy the racism thing, and however, I'm sitting here with Korean Presbyterians who are not very receptive to their problems. The sexism and homophobia is pretty rampant in Latino and Korean communities, and homophobia is pretty prevalent in Black communities. And I was sitting around, can we talk about all of the marginalized realities? Can we do that all at once? Is that...
You're asking people to be intersectional.
Yeah, aren't we evolved enough to talk about all of these things? So I reached out to the African-American preacher. She's from the Atlanta area. And after the conference, I texted her or emailed her, and we had a conversation on the phone. And in that conversation, I found out that she was also a lesbian. I said, what? I didn't know that. I mean, why was that not part of this whole thing? Mm-hmm. Because each of our communities, ethnic communities, we all need to deal with these topics of marginalization. And she spoke and said, well, I went to speak about racism, not about the LGBTQ reality. And in fact, Blake, as a Black woman, on the scale of 1 to 10, being gay is a 2. Being Black is a 10.
Right.
Okay. So as a white LGBTQIA member, you know, a gay man, for me, being homosexual, the marginalization, the effects is a 10.
Right.
And,
from your perspective.
And being a parent of Black children, I've encountered racism in a way that I never did as a white man on my own. But what I've encountered barely gets to a 1. And let me tell you what, that 1 that almost won racism shook me to the core. I can't imagine what it is to be a 10. So I got what she was saying to me, and I understand that I get to serve in a community that's not purple. We're pretty predominantly progressively liberal, and we're becoming multi-ethnic and multiracial as well. And I have a responsibility. I also have kind of a responsibility and a privilege and a gift to be able to speak. And I only speak here in this little building. I get to speak when other pastors are too afraid to speak. And so my words do go beyond these walls on Facebook and SoundCloud. And so I thought, well, it's when I finished talking with the black pastor in Atlanta, I went, well, my job is to speak to the predominantly white congregation that I serve. And it is time for us to be uncomfortable about racism and about how we have allowed it with our silence.
So how are those conversations? You said you were writing a something you were intending to publish.
Yeah, that post I wrote about Purple Church.
I'm guessing it sparked some controversy.
I did. I got some responses from some friends of mine who are pastors who are in Purple Church realities. And they took it as a, you know, kind of a punch in their stomach for me. And because I called it an excuse, mm-hmm. that we often will call Purple Church, and that becomes our excuse. So we don't have to, we can't say anything. Whew. But it's pretty, that becomes our own comfort zone, see? Mm-hmm. And it becomes an excuse to not ever push the issue. So sometimes we go, oh, well, I serve a Purple Church. Oh, that becomes an excuse. It also becomes a way that we can continue to live in our own comfort zone. Mm-hmm. I didn't become a non-purple pastor overnight. So as I looked at it, I realized that it took steps. It took risk. I took risks at steps along the way. And as I continued to take another risk and another risk and another risk, I landed in this place, and I helped create a place that allows us to speak more freely about it. So we're writing, a colleague of mine, an elder, and I are writing this article on Purple Church. And our hope is to say to others who are in shut down, silent, purple realities that it does take a risk, but you don't do it all at once. You take a step, and you keep taking a step, and we really need to do that. That's part of our calling. So we started earlier. We had a few words before you pushed the record button, and one of it was about silence. And we have an incredible history that comes the Reformed Church. We are Presbyterians, but we're Reformed in our theology. So we broke away from the Catholic Church, part of the first wave of Reformation. So we call ourselves a Reformed Church. The Reformed Church had a presence, was alive in Germany during the time of the Nazi era. And there comes a moment when Hitler and the Nazi regime says, there's not going to be a separation between church and state. The state's going to be the head of the church. And then they created a political person that was the political guy in charge of all the churches. And a lot of the churches in Germany went, okay, all right, we'll do that. But there was a group that said, oh, hell no. And I'm sure they said hell in German. One of those people was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Dietrich Bonhoeffer and other Reformed pastors gathered in the city of Barmen, I don't remember what year, and wrote down a statement that said, we will not be part of this church-run, state-run church. And we will oppose it, we will reject it, we will not follow along. That's part of our Book of Confessions. That's part of who we are. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer is one who wrote that if you remain silent, you are now part of the action. You are now part of the injustice. You are now part of the Nazi story. Okay, so then we jump all the way now, and my word, we're looking out into our country, into our current political situation, and going, there's a lot that's looking and sounding a lot like what happened in Germany in the Nazi era. And many churches, many pastors have, purple or not, have no problem talking about the immigration issues and the way children are being treated. So the church, purple churches, are even talking about that. But when you get to the racism thing, and we start to shut down, and many congregations shut down in silence about the homosexual thing as well.
I had heard a great, I can't remember where I heard it, but it was, you know what history calls people who joined the Nazi party because of economic reasons or because of popularism, and what history calls those people is Nazis. It doesn't matter why you joined the party, why you went along with it. We're still a part of the Nazi party. So, you know, you're seeing very similar things happening again. Mm-hmm. You know, what will history say about people who remain silent while these atrocities are happening?
Exactly. Silence is not an option. And we've allowed it to be an option for many, many years in our predominantly white, a lot of suburban, you know, just be comfortable. And so as we were writing, I asked, so what are we doing? What is this purple church? What are we really doing? Because the threat is, don't make me uncomfortable, don't make me mad, or I will leave this church because you need me. You know, I got to have an attendance. You love to write down how many you're attending, and you love even more about my money that I give you to use for your pastor's salary and for the mission that we do and the work that we do. So you really need me, but don't make me mad or I'm leaving. And doesn't that sound a lot like what's happening in Washington with lobbyists? You need you vote that way, baby. I'm not going to give you my money. And I'm going, what are we doing? We have a lot to say about lobbyists and that whole thing and why our politicians aren't it. And then it comes, trickles down into the church, and we're doing the same kind of dance. And
yeah, and I think there are some conversations about white fragility to be had there as well. That, you know, you very often hear, if you're trying to do any sort of anti-racist work, people will say, well, make sure you don't, you know, make sure you keep a nice tone and don't make it too challenging or your allies will leave. Well, then you were never an ally to begin with.
That's purple. You're being purple.
Yeah. So, you know, and it's a knee-jerk white fragility sort of thing. Like, there's actually white fragility bingo cards where you can stamp off these same reactions that you hear whenever someone really starts pushing those issues. So I imagine inside of a church, you still have those same white fragility issues.
Oh, absolutely. I think we're addicted to comfort. Mm-hmm. Comfort over anything else. And for a lot of reasons, we've helped create that in the church. And it hadn't worked for us. You know, a lot of comfortable churches are dying. And so that's, you know, here in this church that I serve, we have pushed, and along the way, people have gotten angry. A few have left. Most people that got mad and left, that happened a long time ago. So we only had a few that left for various reasons, but we have been uncomfortable. And our discomfort has created a healthier environment. What a surprise, you know? So that's what's on the other side of taking a risk, is discovering the vitality that comes. Because all of a sudden, you start engaging with people in a very genuine way. So all of a sudden, people who, we talked about this last time, people who have felt like they could never be part of the church again, but though the people I'm talking about have a yearning to be part of the church, but never believed that they could be part of the church or part of a faith community. And when churches like the one I'm serving became uncomfortable enough, we became a safe place for them. Because we met them in a very genuine way. They knew we had done the work. So we've done the work. We've done more of the work on the LGBTQIA front, less of the work on the racism front, the racist part of it. But we're beginning to speak that. And I mean, I'm beginning to do that. And I kind of vary the topic. I've been pretty like, boo, in your face. And then I right. come back and I do a little softer one. But even the softer one does not let go of the fact that what we were taught as white Americans in this country are just wretchedly wrong. And I live in a historic black community, Whitesboro. And when I started driving around the state or driving around the area, people said, oh, don't drive through there. That is a dangerous neighborhood. Don't drive through there. And if you do, go on 9 and go really fast, you know, so you can get out of there. Well, now I live right in the middle of it. And I would tell you that there was fear. I'm married to a man, and so two white gay men live right in the middle of this community. And I was a little nervous. I was nervous about how people would respond to our sexual orientation. And I was nervous about the white-black, thing. And so there, I talked about this last Sunday, there was apprehension on both sides of the fence. Those who lived there and us moving there. And as I said to people on Sunday, I don't tell this story because I'm better than anyone else. I'm not. I was raised in the same racist reality that all of us have been born into. But I tell you because of what I've learned. I've lived there long enough to know the rhythm of the life in that neighborhood. I lived there long enough to have engaged with my neighbors, who were mainly all black and Latino. And there's really no fear.
Right.
There, I went, what was I afraid of? You know, we've been planting flowers and we sit on our porch. And people that white America taught me to be afraid of is walking across, you know, that person's walking across the front of my yard, and I'm going, you know, doing the white afraid bite my lip and going, I wonder. And he stops and goes, I really like these flowers. Thank you for planting them. And I went, what in the heck? What am I thinking?
Being such an idiot? Right.
Do you see how stupid racism is.
Right, but it's so culturally indoctrinated into white people that every time you see a person of color in popular media and mm-hmm. TV and movies, mm-hmm. they're portrayed a certain way. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's programmed into you from such an early age. And I think this is a conversation that I try to have with people because I'd like to do the calling in instead of calling out, you know, of, okay, you got to this point. You're a product of the culture that you are. Mm-hmm. Now you're aware of that. What are you going to do with that now? You know, that's where it, you that's can't be a
exactly
bad person.
Where I yeah. am. Okay. Exactly where I am. I acknowledge it's taken me years and years and years. It's taken me being a father of biracial children and grandchildren. And it's taken me coming out of the closet and dealing with my own marginalized realities. And what am I going to do? Well, that's what I'm doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I told my mother that I was speaking to you. And like you always say, I come into the church and it's not burning up. And your heart was in the church and it didn't blow up, you know? And I mean, she didn't know. It didn't matter who you were.
Mm-hmm.
She heard that her son would be talking on an internet radio show. Be careful. I said, well, Mom, I'm going to be careful. No, just be careful. And so I was taking it one way. But she says, you just don't know about who hears it and your own safety.
Mm-hmm.
So in the neighborhood, and I said, Mom, I got this. But I also don't got this. I can't live allowing that fear of what people might do to me. That's the fear that kept me silent.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't work. It's not worth it. And I can't do it. So the fear in the neighborhood where I live now isn't the fear of my neighbors anymore. It's the people who drive through it. I live on Highway 9.
Mm-hmm.
They flow through there to go to the shore. And recreational vehicles and Mercedes-Benz and whole communities of motorcycles go through our neighborhood every day. And those big trucks with big wheels, jacked up, with flags on the back of their bed, and mufflers really loud, and they drive through. Their mufflers are a message. They're mm-hmm. a message. And the message is left long after they drive through. We still hear them, and it's a message of threat. And it's not only the mufflers, it's what they yell and what they say, because we're at a stoplight. So we can hear.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a gay flag that flies. And they know they're in a black neighborhood because our white mentality has taught us to know where we are just by looking out the window. Ooh, we better. And they yell things. And they hope that we remember those words. And I say we as a gay man, and I say we as a multi-ethnic, mainly black Latino neighborhood. And they're the ones that create the threat. They're the ones that create a threat going across the front of our church because we have a rainbow board out front and it shuts people down. So even in a not purple church,
mm-hmm.
people are afraid no matter what political color you are, fear wants people to be silent.
Yeah, and I'm thinking there's the Unitarian Church yeah. out by Stockton that proudly puts out a Black Lives Matter sign.
Yeah.
And that sign has been vandalized to the point where they have like a stack of signs in the back
yeah.
that when one gets, they just know it's going to be vandalized and like, okay, time to put up the new sign.
And I know that community and their pride flag has been the target lately. And I know that community well. And it's creating fear
mm-hmm.
in that community. And in that very not purple church reality, the fear still is part of that. Fear just doesn't have a color. That's another thing that Dietrich Bonhoeffer said. Whatever the fear is, whether it's denial or whatever it is, it wants to remain silent. within you. And if it remains silent, it continues to have power over you. But the minute you start speaking it out loud, the pain, the fear no longer has power over you. And that's what it means to come out. That's what it means to address racism. We've allowed that fear to have power over us. And the thing is, when you start speaking and getting to the other side of the risk of speaking, you discover a pretty good life.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of those times where I wish people could see the body language. When you're talking about that fear, like mm-hmm. what you're doing with your hands is actually saying fear keeps you small.
Yeah.
Wait, like he's putting his hands together and making like a little knot with them. And he's like, and then once you get past that and like his arms get really big, you're like the body language is clearly saying fear keeps you small and your life gets so much bigger when you get past it. And it's kind of what the body language is saying, which is another interesting commentary that you didn't even maybe know you were making. Yeah.
Well, I do. I know I had to. I think fear is just a lie.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it's a lie. And we've allowed a lie to exist in our life. And, you know, as much as I detest the current politics and the current presidency, what I've discovered from it is, and I said this not long ago, it's one of the few times in my life, maybe the only time in my life, that I have seen non-marginalized people, mainly white folks, and then the cream of the top, white men, non-marginalized people waking up every day. So I'm serving people who really work to look outside their privilege.
Mm-hmm.
So they are in that mode. But they wake up every day and they're bombarded with the next moment of fear that's being tweeted or spoken. And it's beginning to wear them down. They're for the first time in their life, they are experiencing what it is like to wake up every day in a marginalized situation. And so they're not even on the one.
Right. They're like 0.001.
But they're getting closer to the one.
Right.
For the first time in their life. And they don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're afraid. And they're distraught. And I said, well, that's what every black person has experienced in our country and every gay person that has experienced. Women, you know, the whole list of all the isms. So welcome. But here's the deal. It's not the end. It's not the end. And so don't let the fear shut you down. And that's what I was telling them. A lot of gay folks here and some of our racial, ethnic folk here, we have a gift for you. We can show you that you can live past the fear.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Well, I think that's a great place to end it, is that, you know, not letting the fear control you, that, okay, you've got the fear, now you've got a great opportunity to move.
Yeah, what was
that
your
fear
question?
Will make you grow.
What is it going to make you do?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's not to blame.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, what are you going to do?
Yeah, because that fear can also, it can shut you down or it can wake you up.
It's an opportunity to do something.
Yeah, so I think that's a great place, mm-hmm. is leaving people, you know, if you're listening to this, now you have an opportunity.
It's your turn.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Right. And if you are a person, a religious person or a church person, you know, you've got this opportunity, you know.
Yep.
Pastor Blake says you've got this opportunity.
Yes.
And listen to Pastor Blake. Thank you so much for agreeing to
do this
interview. To my listeners, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate you more than you could know. We would not be here if it were not for you. We're here to be a voice for the activist community, for the change makers, for people that are making a difference. And that's why we don't take any corporate money here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. We only take donations from the working class, from the activists, from people that support making a change in the world. And that's why we always have to keep asking you. If at all possible, go on to our website, www.njrevolutionradio.com. Click on that donate button. Even if it's only a couple of bucks a month, it really helps, you know, Brian and I not having to pay for everything out of pocket. And we really appreciate not having to pay for everything out of pocket. But it also enables us to hire people that can report on things for us, people that can go out and live stream events, people that can write columns for us. And we really, you can help us grow. You can help us cover more things. We appreciate you more than you could possibly know. The future is yours to create. Go out there and create it.